I'm turning this evening to the second book of Kings, chapter 3 and verse 1. 2 Kings, chapter 3, verse 1. Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria, the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. The subject this evening, as we go through this chapter, is how we may nullify or negate our faith. And we come to a second study in the ministry of Elisha. Not going to review anything that we've considered, but come straight into this third chapter. Jehoram, the son of Ahab, brother of Ahaziah, the very short reigning son of Ahab, who was his immediate successor, began to reign over Israel in the city of Samaria. And Jehoshaphat is mentioned, king of Judah, and he had been on the throne for 18 years down in the southern kingdom. But about Jehoram, verse 2, he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father and like his mother, Ahab and Jezebel. For he put away the image of Baal that his father had made, that ultimate insult of putting the statue of Baal in the main temple of worship, a false worship, but nevertheless their so-called temple in the north. He removed it, but he didn't actually destroy it, because we read a little later on that it was brought back again subsequently, not in this kingdom, this reign, but later it was only put into some kind of store. And evidently Jehoram, though he got rid of the main image, was still a Baal worshipper, because Elisha as good as says so in a few verses' time, as we shall see. But he wrought evil, because even aside from the Baal worship, he was very faithful to and continued the false worship of the northern kingdom of Israel. Verse 3, nevertheless, he cleaved unto the sins of Jeroboam, strong word, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. And the narrator repeats himself, he departed not therefrom. So he was a staunch defender of the north's invented worship, the northern kingdom of Israel. So the scene is set, and the first heading, the ungodly compromise. Verse 4, and Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheep master, and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool. Well, those who've been to the British Museum will know the Moabite stone, or Mesha steel, which says all this from the Moabite point of view, and claims very similar things. And Mesha is very upset about that. And on his steel, he claims to have succeeded in his rebellion, and the rebellion stood, but it didn't stand for long, because as we shall see in this chapter, he was in due course defeated. But Mesha, king of Moab, rebelled. He rebelled in Ahaziah's short reign. And as soon as Jehoram came to the throne in Israel, he determined to reverse that setback and bring Moab once again under subjection to Israel. But it came to pass when Ahab was dead that the king of Moab rebelled against the king of Israel. This is 853 BC. And King Jehoram went out of Samaria the same time. The same time is a very broad term there. It was actually 2 years after the rebellion, and numbered all Israel. But it's the same time. It's the first thing he did when he came to the kingdom. But then it's verse 7 that particularly interests us. And he went and sent to Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, in the south, saying, "The king of Moab has rebelled against me. Wilt thou go with me against Moab to battle?" Now that's the request. Will Judah join with Israel to recover Moab? No, it was a good thing to do, because Moab wasn't an innocent country. Very small country, east of the Dead Sea, but it was on land it shouldn't have been on, and it was a marauding kingdom at that time, and it would have given considerable trouble. Very hostile to Israel and Judah, would constantly have been attacking, and so on. And so it's a very laudable thing to once again subject Moab. It was a fairly benevolent subjection. The things that were required of Moab, the annual homage in terms of animals and so on, farmed, is quite modest when you consider the size of these places and their produce, and for that they had certain advantages and the protection of Israel and Judah, but it made peace. So it was a sensible thing to quell those very fiery neighbours. But should Judah have so willingly aligned itself with Israel? Did Jehoshaphat think? Supposing the rebellion, the successful rebellion of Moab, had been a judgment of God upon Israel, because Israel, the northern kingdom, was in a state of very serious sin. Not only had they invented a false version of Judaism for themselves, not only were they breaking the whole nation and keeping themselves apart, but morality had collapsed. There were no, because of the false worship, there were no priests and Levites in the north. It was left to the ministry of the prophets, and they were completely self-supporting. They were the original poor preachers in the north. At this stage, they're under the leadership of Elisha. Well, Israel had lost their prosperity and come into extortion and poverty and so on. Should Judah have been so willing to assist them in this venture and align with them, even though it was a good thing to do? And this was the reply of Jehoshaphat, halfway through verse 7, or end of verse 7, and he said, "I will go up. I am as thou art. My people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses." This is very strong solidarity and brotherliness. The north, and Jehoram, he's a heretic. He's an evildoer. He's a shocking character. And that's the state the north is in. And the south is, on the whole, under a good king, Jehoshaphat. He's applauded. He does well. He worships sincerely. He promotes the right things. He's nothing like Jehoram. There is no likeness between them at all. It was different as chalk and cheese. "I will go up. I am as thou art. My people as thy people, and my horses as thy horses." This is extraordinary. But it's even more extraordinary when you remember that Jehoshaphat has made this very mistake before. He has form, as they say. He aligned himself before with a rogue cause, which he shouldn't have done. And he burned his fingers badly on account and suffered a punishment from the Lord. And now he falls again. You wonder how to account for this. Is he so incredibly easygoing? For all his soundness, his theological soundness, and his faithfulness, and his loyalty, why does he have absolutely no sense of the holiness of God in this matter, and God's will, and whether he should be closely aligned with the enemies of God. That's something he just doesn't seem to see. And it's the second time he's done this. So it's recorded for our learning. A case of compromise. Jehoshaphat ruined his stand by this tendency to align himself with people who were nothing like him. Well, you can apply this in a number of ways, but it's a terrible thing. Look at verse 8 for the moment. And he said, Jehoshaphat, which way shall we go up? And Jehoram answered, the way through the wilderness of Edom. Now some of the commentators pounce on this, and they say, well, this was crazy to go through the desert. In some ways it was a sensible thing, marching a great southerly circle to come up to Moab from the south through a dry wilderness area. They were bound to get stuck there. But whatever the moral deficiencies of Jehoram and the mistake of Jehoshaphat, they were very astute military commanders. We shouldn't take them for fools on this. They planned a very smart route. This was the side from which Moab was completely undefended. And they knew, and their scouts and their people knew the water courses. They knew which way to go. They knew where they could get water supplies up through that desert terrain. And so they set out. Verse 9. So the king of Israel went, and the king of Judah, and the king of Edom, and they fetched a compass, that is to say, they took a semicircular route of 7 days' journey, and there was no water for the host. Well, they were taken by surprise, because there should have been. They knew the areas where they could go. This is an act of God. This isn't their foolishness. They knew the terrain. They had scouts on this territory constantly. But it is an act of God. All the water courses, sources and so on were dried up. And they were stuck. And there was no water for them or for the cattle that followed them to feed the armies, considerable numbers of men. And verse 10, you have to read this right. The king of Israel, from the north, Jehoram, the godless one, said, alas, that the Lord, capital letters, Jehovah, the true God, hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab. Now you must read that right. He's furious. He's angry. And he's insolent about God. And vindictive, and he blames God for their plight. Well, God certainly is responsible. It's by an act of God the water sources have been dried up. But he blames God in the sense that he accuses him of being a capricious, vindictive God who's just brought them into destruction and trouble. He's no love for God, he's no worshipper of the true God. So you have to see hatred in these words. Alas, that the Lord hath called these three kings together. What about you, Jehoram? Didn't it cross your mind that it may be on your account that there's trouble, that the water courses are dried up, that you're plunged into danger? You're the most evil of them. The king of Edom's nothing like as bad as you. And Jehoshaphat worships piously the true God. You're the trouble. He doesn't see that, of course. He's an enemy of God, an unbeliever. So he thinks the Lord has called all three kings just to destroy them for his pleasure. This is a God who has outbursts, and he does things just to enjoy himself. Destroy for no reason. Three kings. That's the attitude of Jehoram in the north, in that 10th verse. really. Verse 11, what a contrast. But Jehoshaphat, for all his folly, he was a godly man. He said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord, that we may inquire of the Lord by him? And one of the king of Israel's servants, a courtier to Jehoram, said, here is Elisha. He wasn't actually there, but he was obviously nearby. God had spoken to Elisha. He'd told him, evidently, exactly what was taking place, and to move up there and to be on hand. And he was camped down in a village nearby, or perhaps even in a tent nearby, and it was known. But look at the scornful way the servant of Jehoram says this. Here is Elisha, the son of Shaphat, which poured water on the hands of Elijah. And what is implied there? He's merely a servant of Elijah, who was famous with us, even though we didn't like him in the north. For Elisha, the junior prophet, now that Elijah is dead, is here. And verse 12, Jehoshaphat said, the word of the Lord is with him. I don't think he knew him, but he knew about him. Elisha operated in the north, in Israel. I don't think Jehoshaphat had probably met him down in Judah, but he had knew his reputation. The word of the Lord is with him. So the three kings went down to him. And there are things we can draw even from that. I remember some years ago, there was a leading evangelical preacher in the United States made an arrangement to debate with the late Christopher Hitchens, the militant atheist writer, who was an extremely unpleasant individual in many, many ways, in speech, his attacks on spiritual things, the outrageous things he would come out with, and so on. And he called him my favourite atheist. And they had their debate on some university campus in the United States. It was televised. There was great attention given to it. They had their debate. And I've seen bits of it, you know, video. And terribly polite, terribly friendly, terribly pleasant to each other. And then you think of this down here, verse 13. Elisha said unto Jehoram, king of Israel, what have I to do with thee? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and to the prophets of thy mother. And the king of Israel said unto him, nay, for the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hands of Moab. Do something about it. This is unreasonable of your God to do this. Placate him in some way. You're his prophet. You know how. He shouldn't be doing this. That's the spirit of Jehoram. And Elisha said, as the Lord of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee, nor see thee. So you get a leading preacher saying of a most militant atheist, my favourite atheist, lovely man, all this type of thing. How different today. You wouldn't have caught Elijah or Elisha speaking like that of someone who was an enemy of God. It's compromise. Jehoshaphat hadn't seen it. I am as you are. My people as your people. My horses as your horses. We're absolutely one. Nothing of the kind. You know, the doctrine of biblical separation is very important. It's vital. Elijah was noted as being, and Elisha followed him, jealous for the Lord of hosts, ready to defend his honor, never friendly towards his enemies, never commending them. Goes on constantly these days. You get some evangelical people in the, not all of them, but some of them who are in mainline denominations where the vast majority of clergy or ministers will be liberal, hostile to the gospel and the inspired word. And you find so many of them cooperating with them, 100%, hand in hand with them, joining with them, accepting their counsel and their leadership and supporting them. You would never have seen Elijah and Elisha doing that sort of thing. You would never have seen the Puritans doing that. You would never have seen the great heroes of faith down the centuries, the great revival instruments. Always biblical separation was maintained. Of course we'll be courteous. Of course we won't be insulting. Well, we will be very clear, we won't cooperate with people who are the enemies of the Lord. This was Jehoshaphat's big mistake here, and he had to suffer considerable embarrassment and burn his fingers on account of it. But we go on. So Elisha could scarcely bring himself to look at Jehoram because of his evil, his sin. Verse 15, now bring me a minstrel. And it came to pass, when the minstrel played, that the hand of the Lord came upon him. Obviously a minstrel with a harp and psalms, singing psalms. Why? Why a minstrel? Well, it's obvious, friends. Elisha was disgusted at Jehoram. Elisha saw him and saw this man who was the representative of rebellion and evil and misleading the people in the north for the time being. And his whole spirit was filled with righteous indignation. Now to call upon the Lord, he needed to have a different frame of mind. To call upon the Lord, he had to be filled with love for the Lord and indebtedness. His heart had to be touched. He had to switch away from this. And so you see these wonderful words, bring me a minstrel. Now that's like a motto text to us. Sunday morning, Lord's Day morning, perhaps you have a family, certain amount of noise, clamour, difficult finding everything for the youngsters, get them ready for departure, they're bound to lose a shoe or something, so much to do, get into church on time if you can. Your motto text is, bring me a minstrel. This is worship. I've got to be settled. I've got to reflect. I've got to repent. I've got to express to the Lord my love and indebtedness. I've got to be in the right spirit for this. You can't do that if you come at 11:05. I try to understand the friends who come at 11:05. When did they compose themselves? When did they prepare for worship? When did they bring a minstrel and adjust their hearts and get ready? Different on Wednesday night. You've got to pour in here when you can, 10:05, because you've been in employment. Some people have come here without a meal even, to hear the word of God. I'm not going to criticise anybody rushing in a few minutes late. Hope that's not a licence, but on Bible study night, but on Sunday? Bring me a minstrel, friends. Same whenever we go to prayer. Compose ourselves. Read a psalm. Read a hymn. Tune your heart. Be in the right frame. Love the Lord. Be grateful to Him. Recount your blessings. Get ready. And the motto text for that is, bring me a minstrel. Elisha does that. Verse 15. And it came to pass, when the minstrel played, that the hand of the Lord came upon him. Prayer will be much more fervent if we've had that minstrel stage at the beginning of it. Much more earnest, much closer to the Lord. Verse 16. And Elisha spoke, and he said, thus saith the Lord, make this valley full of ditches. There was not going to be a blessing in this instance without work being done. And there's a message in that. God will never bless a lazy church. So have a picture in your mind of two churches. One of them prays earnestly for souls and knocks the doors of the neighborhood and distributes literature and invites people in and brings the children and instructs them and gets on with the work. The other doesn't. They both have a fervent prayer meeting. One labors as well and the other does nothing. Who's going to be blessed? In this instance, there's going to be no miracle, no deliverance without work, without blood, sweat and tears. Make this valley full of ditches. And they had to get digging because there was going to be water and it must be collectible and irrigate the area and must be able to get the cattle at it and so on. And that's vital. Why? Some people pray for revival as though it means that God will move in such a way that we won't have to do anything and we'll be spectators of this remarkable blessing. Well, revival is amazing. When people in a neighborhood, in a town or a village, suddenly, unaccountably, start streaming into church. And they're moved and affected. And people who've been hard as nails are longing and thirsting for something. It's astonishing. It's the power of God. And yet, revival wears everybody out. That's an aspect of revival you have to consider. When revival or awakening comes, the people of God are never so busy. Tireless for the Lord. Preachers almost drop from exhaustion with the read properly into revival. See the number of John Kennicks there are who collapse week after week under the strain. So it is here. God will not bless lazy people. Make this valley full of ditches, for thus saith the Lord, ye shall not see wind, neither shall ye see rain, yet that valley shall be filled with water, that ye may drink, both ye and your cattle and your beasts. And not only was that a miraculous provision to save their lives, but it was a sign. Verse 18, and this is but a light thing in the sight of the Lord. He will deliver the Moabites also into your hands. Verse 19, the choice cities are in all probability the military cities of Moab, the border cities, not every city, but the cities where the militia were based and so on. And verse 20, the valleys are filled with water, and then there's the rest of the chapter recounts the victory over the Moabites, who were punished too for their rebellion. but we've time to do just a little in chapter 4. And I look at the first verse. Now there cried a certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets unto Elisha, saying, Thy servant, my husband, is dead, and thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord, and the creditor is come to take unto him my two sons to be bondmen. This moves into a series of miracles worked by Elisha, which are to God's people. There's four of them which are just for God's people. And this is the first of them. We won't go any further than this in the short time that we have left. But the scene is very touching. The prophets were poor, and they had little support from the community. Things had gone down so far that the benevolent laws of Israel were ignored. So here's one lady, and she's lost her husband. He had a good reputation. Elisha knew him well. Thou knowest that thy servant did fear the Lord. He was well spoken of among the prophets, a faithful and a holy man. But he's left his wife impoverished. That's inevitable. The prophets can't help much. They're all in the same boat. They're very poor. Now, she should have been supported by the community, but we can only assume that the community around her, the village or the town, wouldn't help her, because although they'd lend her pots, they wouldn't help her because she was the widow of a prophet, and they hated the prophets. They were half of them Baal worshippers, and the rest of them worshippers of the false religion of the north, which they resented this. So her plight was terrible, and she's going to be possessed, thrown out of her home, and the rich landowner is going to take her two sons. How old were they? Well, old enough to collect pots. Let's imagine 13, 14. Old enough to be desirable and worth selling into slavery. Shouldn't have happened. The laws of Israel forbade it. Somebody who was destitute was not to be pressed for debts. That was the law. But this is the northern kingdom, and they're far from the laws of God, and they've ignored them. So what's to be done? How is she to be helped? Verse 2, Elisha said unto her, What shall I do for thee? Well, you might think that's a strange question. What shall I do for thee? The Lord ask questions like that too during his earthly ministry. What wilt thou? Makes the person, the suffering person in his case, who was sick and desired healing, think about it, what it was that he was seeking. And this lady, this woman, she scarcely knows what to say. There's no reply recorded, because all she can think is, Lord, Elisha, help me. Will God help me? She doesn't feel worthy to ask for a miracle. She dare not say boldly, Well, sir, you have the power. If God gives it to you, can you provide for me? She won't ask that. Just, I don't know. But can you help me? My children are about to be seized, and I shall be thrown out. What shall I do for thee? And then he goes on, Tell me, what hast thou in the house? All she has is a pot of oil, but everything she has is demanded of her. What have you? Is it all in the hands of the Lord? If you want a blessing from him, and you want help from him, is everything you are and everything you have in the hands of the Lord? And she said, thine handmaid hath not anything in the house save a pot of oil. Now oil was quite valuable, but she needed it. Then he said, go borrow thee vessels abroad of all thy neighbours, even empty vessels, borrow not a few. Hebrews says something like, don't hold back. You need a great number. And when thou art come in, thou shalt shut the door upon thee and upon thy sons, and shalt pour out into all those vessels, and thou shalt set aside that which is full. Well, you may know the narrative. So she went from him, shut the door upon her and upon her sons. It's a private miracle. Who brought the vessels to her. They did all the fetching and carrying, and she poured out. And when the vessels were full, verse 6, she said, bring me another vessel. And he said, there's not a vessel more. And at that point, the oil stayed. Then she came and told the man of God. And he said, go sell the oil, pay thy debt, and live thou and thy children off the rest. Well, it wouldn't support them for long, but it would support them for long enough, presumably, for the boys to be able to be at work and that kind of thing. And that's the end of that particular miracle. First observation, and we're coming to conclusion. It was a miracle for godly people, and it was private. They're to shut the door. The neighbours mustn't see this. Why not? Well, because if the neighbours saw it, they might confess the Lord also to get a miracle and to get support and to get provision. So it's a secret miracle. It's for her. It's the Lord's blessing for that family. It isn't to be an enticement to the neighbours. That's quite the wrong reason for coming to God or coming to Christ. How wrong the charismatics have got it. We want miracles so that we can entice people. And people can say in their hearts, we want some of that. So it's a private miracle, because that's not the purpose of miracles. Oh yes, lots of miracles were public in Bible times because they were authenticating prophets or authenticating the Lord. Or they were national warnings and encouragements to the nation. But miracles to people, to enrich, to help, to support them, were not enticements to others. They were private miracles. So we learn that from this passage. It's a very important passage. Secondly, and I mentioned this, second observation is that there was something for people to do. It wasn't a miracle which bypassed all human instrumentality and effort, and they had to render up what they had. And that's an interesting lesson for miracles. But then thirdly, the pots that were brought, obviously, had to be empty. Wouldn't have been a blessing if there'd been anything in any of those pots. The miracle could only be carried out and be successful if the pots were empty. And we have to be empty if God is going to provide for us and help us and give us the capacity we crave to witness, to speak, to teach, to help, to minister to others. No pride in us, half filling the pot. No worldliness, polluting the interior of the pot. No self-sufficiency or self-confidence. Trust in our own capacities. The pot clearly has to be empty. And then it's interesting, this is very like a miracle that was given to Elijah. And some people have criticized it on that account. And people who are hostile to the Bible say, this isn't, what's this narrative? It's not even original. The writer of this second book of Kings is really just copying and adapting what happened to Elijah. There's a similarity. Of course there's a similarity, because the miracle is saying something there, that God's handiwork is always noticeable. It's an endorsement of Elisha that he can do exactly what Elisha did. Very similar blessings, similar things. You see God's handiwork in every conversion. Every conversion is different, and yet there are fundamentals that are exactly the same. And we're not surprised that Elisha could do something which was similar to that which Elijah did. But then, finally, this is very beautiful to me. This poor woman, she is not even named. She is obscure. She's the wife of one of the prophets. You can't pinpoint her. When you go to heaven, if you want to meet her, you can't take a name with you. I'm sure you'd find her if you wanted to. If you asked after the 2 Kings chapter 3 widow woman, but she has no name in the Bible. But she had a great need, and she was a child of God. She was a faithful woman. And when Elisha says, what shall I do for you? She doesn't know. But one thing is certain, she's going to be provided for. She's going to be blessed. The miracle was for her and her family. Puts you in mind of Damaris, doesn't it? In the book of Acts, and a woman named Damaris, named with a handful of others at Athens, who were saved. Obscure woman, there was this tremendous blessing. And for you and for me, whoever we are, unknown in this world, but we pray to God for his blessing and for instrumentality, and miracles of grace come constantly. They're for us, even the most lowly and the most obscure is blessed of God, from God's hand. So there's a lot to note from this particular passage. Our time is up. Whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through comfort of the scriptures, might have hope. And so is this passage. And we'll look in future weeks at some of the other miracles for believers. I was going to turn you for a second, but I won't tonight, to 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verses 9 and 10, where we see the Apostle Paul's rules for supporting widows in the church. It's relevant to this. She was a godly woman. So there was this miracle which was a token of support for her personal and financial and family situation. Can we support every widow? No, says the apostle. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 9. Here are the qualifications for your compassionate support of people. In so many words, have they lived for the Lord? And so on. We show compassion beyond that, but not substantial compassion. And you can consult with that and link it with this miracle to the widow woman in chapter 4 of 2 Kings. That's enough for us to cover this evening. Let's sing together the hymn 495.